Mix.
You can email us anytime, rad@radradio.com. Phones work as well, 888-989-9811. That is the sound of an email. That's what I'm going to start with after I introduce co-hosts live from Las Vegas and from MixPicks.com. 2Ks and Mix, 2Ks and Picks, MixPicks.com. Steve Mickelson. Hello, Steve.
Good morning.
All right, Steve. This is an email that actually kind of dovetails off of the Friday 3-hour post-draft day one of the NFL draft show, a 3-hour special that we did for the Mixed Picks Sports Show, because since we had extra time, we were also able to dive into some off-the-wall kind of things. When you have more time, we could get into personal stories. You told your New Orleans stories, for example. But we also alluded to some other things that elicited this email from Smith, who says, and I'm going to take a crack at this first, Steve, and let you kind of fill in the holes afterwards. He says, "Hey, Rob, will you please explain what a handicap is in golf? I just don't understand it. And while you're at it, Steve said he bowled in scratch leagues. What the hell is that?" So, and it's so ironic to use these two different games, sports, if you want to call them that, as examples. But Steve and I have a history in both. Steve, the more prolific bowler. I'm not prolific at either of them, but I've done both for years. So in golf, the handicap, this is the technical thing, and I'll try to explain it, is the number that indicates your skill level, and it's used like a handicap as sports is to make the game fair if you're competing against others. In other words, the lower the handicap, the better player. So when I was in my prime, I had a handicap of 12, which meant that I'm on average, I'm going to shoot 12 over par, mid-80s. And that would mean if I was playing somebody who had a handicap of 18, meaning they would usually shoot 18 over par, low 90s, I had to give them 6 strokes on the 6 most difficult holes, for example. The irony of the two is, in bowling, they do it the right way, which is the opposite way, which is they tell you what your average is. So, for example, when I stopped bowling league in spring of 2020, when COVID hit, I was averaging 210, which means I could go out on an average night, you play 3 games a night, bowl a 200, a 220, and a 210. Your average is 210, right? Right. There's this wacky adjustment thing. You can take 80 or 90% of another team's average. It's very convoluted, and numbers are hard-spoken word. But let's say, for example, I'm on a 5-man team, and we all average 200. I'm going to make it easy for numbers. So that means our team averages pins per game. The team we're playing, they all have an average of 180, each one of them. So they have 900 is their average, meaning our team has is 100 points better on average than theirs is. We have to give them a head start. Depending on the league, it's 90% of 100, 80%, et cetera. What do you want to add to that, Steve, to where we don't lose everybody? What I love about this show is that we have so many non-sports, non-game fans who are listening and learning, while we also have these deep inside sports fans that are listening and learning. I'm trying to not bore any of them. So what'd I miss?
Where I would go with it is the bowling handicap and take it to an individual. Normally, bowling leagues are 80% of 200 for an average. So if you average 200 or higher, you're not going to get any handicap, and it's actually bonus because you actually average higher than what it is. But if you average 100, you're going to get 80% of 200. So 200 minus 100 is 100, and then you're going to get 80% of that. So you're going to get an 80 pins per game handicap. So if you bowl your average of 100, your score at the end when they add the handicap is going to be 180. The reason they don't go at the full 200% is because a 100 average bowler has a lot more room for improvement because a perfect game is a 300 than if you're a 210 average bowler, as Rob said he was. He can only bowl 90 pins over his average, where a 100 average bowler can bowl 200 pins over their average. So they take each person, whatever their average is, they subtract it from 200. So you get that number, you times it by 80, and that's what your handicap is.
And the thing I didn't answer for, what was this guy's name? For Smith, is specifically to get to the second part of the question is, Steve was talking about when he bowled, which I was blown away on Friday to learn he hasn't competitively bowled in 20 years. Steve's an excellent bowler, like way out of my league, but it's been 20 years. But when he did bowl, he bowled in what are called scratch leagues. And scratch leagues mean no handicap, no head start. Usually, in my experience, they demand a minimum average. Like, you can't even sign up and be in a scratch league unless you are averaging this number. And they'll set the number, whether it's you have to have a 180 average or a 200, 220. I don't know how they're doing it these days. When I went, and the reason I haven't bowled in a scratch league since my mid-20s, because all of the scratch leagues in both Reno when I was there physically and now in the Northern California area, Sacramento, they all start late. They're all like 9 p.m. ideas. And when I'm in my mid to late 20s, I can pull off being up until midnight and then getting up at 3 a.m. and doing a morning show. As Steve knows, because we're both old as dirt, time quickly tells you, no, you know, you can't do that anymore. So I don't even consider it. When I was bowling, I tried to bowl in one of the more competitive leagues. It wasn't scratch, but it was all high-end bowlers, and it was man against man and team against team. But that's what a scratch league means, is Steve's going out there with his whatever it was, probably 240 average. He's bowling against guys that also have like 230 averages, and there's no give or take. There's no head start. It's just mono a mono, team on team kind of thing. Did you in your scratch league, Steve, did they do it? I mean, as long as we're diving into this, just real quick, did you do the thing that I just described where you were bowling against the guy who matched you on the lineup? Like, if you bowl, like, I always lead off. I bowl first for our team. So I have to beat the leadoff guy on the other team, and then you also take point total. So I could lose to the leadoff guy, and then our team wins, and of course your team then all clowns me because I lost to my guy. But that's how I've always seen it structured in really competitive leagues.
Yes, that's how it is. You match them up, and you're bowling your opponent head-to-head, and then you're bowling as a team, your team versus their team. It's a lot of fun because there is no handicap. It's, as you said, mano a mano. Here you go. Who's the best bowler? And where I would add to that, and I don't know about the bowling centers Rob hung out at, one of the advantages or distractions is usually after these late leagues, because now you're rolling at 11:30 or so, nothing's going on. That's where a lot of the pot games, where you start throwing money in.
Oh yeah.
And you start bowling against these other bowlers head to head for money. Those things kick up usually after those scratch leagues as well.
And they can get very expensive very quickly, especially because a lot of guys, even scratch bowlers, a lot of guys like to imbibe in adult beverages while they're bowling. So by the time the league is over, their inhibitions have been released, and it's like Friday night at the casino. They're like, yeah, come on, Mickelson, I can thank you. Pretty soon that's what leads to a lot of those type of things. But again, we talked about it in depth on Friday, the camaraderie, the fun of it. You all have your games. Well, I mean, your hobbies, your things like that, that you can relate to. We're going to bounce around a little bit today to get caught up. We are going to talk more about the draft and such, but I'm wearing my primetime sweatshirt, my hoodie here, because I'm not from Colorado. I don't know anything about the Buffaloes, the university or anything like that. I do love Deion. I've always loved Deion. Not just because he played for the 49ers for a little while. I mean, remember, he played for the Cowboys also. I've always thought the presence of Deion, I'm not vouching for him as a man. I don't know him or whatever, but he obviously took over the Buffaloes program with quite a splash last year. In the end, the season ended exactly the way Steve said it would. Deion came out with a splash, and then the team that was the team showed up. You can only do so much because your name is Deion Sanders. Over the weekend, he reiterated his commitment to the Buffaloes program, saying he has no plans to leave to follow his sons to the NFL. Both Shadur, the quarterback, and Shiloh, his sons, are seniors set to play their final seasons. Shadur is still projected to be one of the top quarterbacks available in the 2025 draft. Yes, we're already talking about next year's draft. In fact, I saw Sunday morning, I already saw the first mock draft for 2025 and just laughed out loud. This is what we do as sports fans. Deion says, quote, I'm a father, not a baby daddy. I don't follow my kids. I pave roads for my kids. I lead my kids. I don't follow my kids. I do not plan on following my kids to the NFL. I have work to do here, end quote. Now, couple questions, Steve. Notice he says, I do not plan on following my kids. Well, of course, that's how you have to say it. A, because what are you going to do? Say, oh, yeah, I'm leaving after this year, become a lame duck coach and piss off the Buffaloes. So that's, you got to say that. But Deion has a history of going on TV and doing interviews saying, look, this is his world. This is his faith. I do not question it. I listen to him. I believe him. He says, I go where my faith leads me. And that's how he explained moving to Colorado. His faith took him there. Can we believe any of this?
No. And as you said, he's going to go where he wants to go. If a team in the NFL ponies up enough money and has an interesting enough opportunity for him, he's going to go to the NFL. He has to say this because he doesn't want to lose recruits for the Colorado Buffaloes. He's got to have the athletic director and all the alumni to have faith in him that he's doing what he's there to do, which is build this program up to a national power. And another part that no one talks about, if his kids are going to go play in the NFL, one thing that actually would work to his advantage is if he's a college football coach, he can coach on Saturday. He can go that night to the NFL the next day and go watch his kids. So you don't know if it's a lot about watching his kids or if he wants to coach his kids. I'd always said he's going to want to be a package deal to be the head coach for whatever team drafts Shadur so he can, you know, coach his kid in the NFL. But right now he's focused on Colorado. He needs to be focused in Colorado. I'm curious to see where he goes because, again, like last year, there was uproar of, oh, all these players are transferring out of Colorado. But if you look this time, it was more offense and defensive linemen. Well, that was the weakness of the Buffaloes last year. They couldn't block. And their defensive line was terrible. Of course you want those guys to be transferring out because if I'm – you know, Dion, those are the spots I'm recruiting heavily to try to bring in much better offensive line, defensive line, so maybe we can get to 500 this year.
Now, Caleb Williams won the Heisman Trophy 2 years ago. There was a lot of speculation about him coming out after his junior year. He stuck around. He didn't win the Heisman. But the whole time, he was already deemed after winning the Heisman, he's going to go number one in the draft. Well, he did, as it turned out. It seems that one to me is the fluke. It seems so silly. We're a year away from the draft. But I ask you, Steve, right now, based on what you know, is Shadur Sanders as a quarterback a number one pick going in the first 32 picks right now, based on what we know, without even another season under him when it comes to the 2025 draft?
I would give you a first round pick, not a first overall pick.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And that's where we get to the interesting, juicy part that we can talk about, especially as we get back into football in the fall, is if it's a top 15-ish pick, give or take, usually you're talking about one of the teams that's rebuilding, maybe they've lost a coach, that kind of thing. And that's where we start to get to the interesting part of during the offseason of the NFL before the draft, does one of those teams, not that another team can't trade up or whatever, but a team with a coaching vacancy after Black Monday when the regular season ends, do they go to Dion? And part of the offer that he can't refuse that you're alluding to is, not only will we give you all this, whatever you want, but we're going to make sure we draft your son as quarterback, whether as starter or as backup, and then you move him into the whole, because that is hard to pass up, I think, for almost any mother or father in whatever scenario, and especially Dion.
I agree with you on that. That would be a tough pass, but keep in mind, to get that scenario, you have to be a bad enough team to fire your coach.
Yeah.
And you also have to be a bad enough team at the quarterback position that you're going out trying to find your franchise quarterback. Because if you're Carolina Panthers and you got Bryce Young, are you really moving on from Bryce Young after 2 years? Probably not. So you need to have both openings, the quarterback opening and the head coach opening, to make that enticing.
Now, again, this is ridiculous that we're even having this conversation, but this is what's so much fun. Two of our potential predicted landing spots for Dion are on the table at this moment. If the Dallas Cowboys don't go to the Super Bowl, at least, I think you said win the Super Bowl, I'm not sure. McCarthy's out of a job. Well, Dak Prescott also doesn't have a contract right now. So, at the end of the season, they still haven't signed Dak. McCarthy goes. Jerry Jones picks up the phone. Hey, Dion, I'm going to offer you all the money in the world. You come down here to the Big D. You know, you played here. I'll put you in the Ring of Fire, or whatever the hell they call it, and I'll draft Shadur. There's one. Here's another example. I'm not saying I like this one because I love Antonio Pierce as head coach of the Raiders. Raiders don't have a quarterback. Raiders have a bad year. You know how their patience is. Fire him. Same thing, because Mr. I mean, imagine Dion as Mr. Las Vegas. Those two scenarios are the ones we've talked about most often, and they are still possible as of this moment right now.
Yes, both of those are still on the table. I find it interesting because as a fan, I would love to see Dion go to either Dallas or the Raiders. And not that I think he's going to be successful with the Raiders, but boy, it would be a fun first couple of years there.
The sideshow.
Deion Sanders in Las Vegas. That would be a lot of fun and the hype that would follow that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Vegas thing writes itself because of exactly that. It's Vegas. It's almost where Deion belongs. The Dallas thing, where Jerry Jones rules with his iron fist and your coach never speaks out unless Jerry's next to you, that ain't Deion. And the fireworks that could happen there is what makes that one so palpably interesting.
But I think it would work because Deion could be the flash in the media and draw that attention and back, you know, Jerry Jones off a little bit. I don't think he's going to be the one trying to make all the decisions outside of his son. So he's not going to be a meddling head coach who wants to be the GM. He's just going to sit back and say, you know, let me deal with the media. Let me build the hype for the, and he's already played for Jerry Jones. So he knows who he is. So for me, I think that scenario might be able to work as well.
So as long as we're halfway into the draft and halfway into the NFL, let's do a couple of looking in the rearview mirrors thing. We had the weekend now, Steve. Do you have a standout winner, best team, the team that did the best? You know, everybody has their grades. I mashed them together. I looked at Mel Kiper. I looked at USA Today and Fox News and Sports Illustrated. There pretty much is a consensus on the teams that did really well and not so well. But we're going to start. Do you have a team or even two where you go, they nailed it? They ran away with the draft.
Now, I really haven't looked at the mock drafts. So this is just kind of off of what I sat down and watched. The couple of teams that I really liked, I liked the Eagles. I thought the Eagles did really well. I liked the Commanders, the Steelers, and believe it or not, I liked the Chargers. And I know the Chargers got beat up. Oh, it wasn't a sexy pick with Joe Alt. Oh, my goodness. This line is greatly improved to protect Herbert. So those, to me, were the four teams that were winners. And again, I don't know where they came out with the draft, you know, grades, but those were the teams to me.
So, and you said it, grades. This is how we do it. We grade these teams, just like we're back in school. So, Eagles, Chargers, Commanders. Consensus, they were all A's or A minuses. So, Steve, you should be a professional sports guy of some kind because you're right. You're right in line in that sense. The Steelers were one of two teams that overwhelmingly got an A+. Because a lot of people say the Steelers took a monster rookie haul that should immediately remediate their offensive line. Third-round wide receiver Roman Wilson, they say, is a home run hitter, most do. They bring up third-round linebacker Peyton Wilson, who a lot of people say the only issue with him is his injuries or his health status, but if he's turned it all around, basically the Steelers stole the draft in a lot of people's minds, and that's why they're one of two teams that got an A+.
Good to hear. I'm feeling better about the draft right now.
But you didn't mention the other team that got an A+ that everybody's rolling over and salivating over, and that's the Chicago Bears. They got Caleb. They got another wide receiver. He's got all the weapons Caleb does. They got a round five pass rusher from Kansas that might come out and really surprise people, and people are just drooling over how great the Bears did.
I like the Bears. You pick 1 and 9. You really shouldn't miss them anyway. I mean, come on. You get the best player in the draft at 1. They got Odunze, who I think could be the best wide receiver in this entire draft. But where I struggle is, you know, they had 5 picks. One of the picks was a punter. I just do not believe in taking a kicker in the draft at all. Go to the free agency, go find someone. So that's where I knocked the Bears down a little bit. Yes, first 2 picks, wonderful selections, but only 5 picks and one of them being a punter. So really you're looking at 4 players out of your draft.
And I'm like you, Steve, I didn't dive too deep into this after watching a little bit of Friday night. But the other teams that have been mentioned as getting either A scores or just in that top tier that we haven't mentioned at all are the Giants, the Rams, the Colts, and the Vikings. I'm not super intelligent to comment on most of them. Most of the Vikings hype is over moving up to get J.J. McCarthy, which we talked about the why of that on Friday so that they have a quarterback who you say you probably won't start the season, but it won't be long before he is the starter in Minnesota. The Giants, the Rams, and the Colts also up there. I don't know if anything stands out to you. I mean, look, the Giants got Malik Nabers. I just don't know if Daniel Jones Jr. can throw the ball to him.
And that's the question. But at least they're giving him the opportunity. They have all the money invested in him. If he can't get the job done next year, they go and look, and they still have the weapons and everything they've picked up. So I like, just like with the Arizona Cardinals, I like the fact that they stuck with their quarterback, said, look, it's show me time. This is it. You better step up. No more excuses and prove that you deserve it. Plus, you get to move that guaranteed money farther down the road in the sense of you got one more year out of it, so you're not, if you choose to move on, burning as much money as, say, the Denver Broncos did when they moved on from Russell Wilson.
Now, when it comes to the team that did the worst, without even looking, when I woke up Sunday morning and I saw, here's the grades, here's who did the best and the worst, my answer without clicking on the story was, not necessarily in this order, the Raiders and the Falcons. For similar reasons. A, the Raiders, we talked about it in depth on Friday. Flat-footed, it felt like, panicked. Bowers is a great tight end. Who's going to throw to him, etc.? So they have this giant hole that they didn't address in quarterback. And the Falcons, for this pick that still, to me, boggles my mind. And I clicked on, and most teams are mentioning, obviously, the Falcons. Most writers, most pundits, the Raiders. Who did you have on your worst list?
For me, the worst was, without a doubt, the Falcons. Mm-hmm. I'm still scratching my head. And, you know, we talked about it, but even thinking about it further over the weekend, the part that still puzzles me even more, and for the most part, I haven't heard anybody talking about it. Michael Penix Jr., to me, was the most ready quarterback coming out of college to start. And I know there's Caleb Williams as the number one pick, but Penix Jr. logged a lot of games in college. He's ready to play right now. I don't think it's that big of a step up. I don't think there should be a whole lot of learning curve. And he's still two more years away, really, before he's going to be given an opportunity. I have to feel for Michael Penix Jr. because this was the worst thing that could happen to him. In a sense, you could say this just killed his NFL career.
And that's kind of been reaffirmed. You know, now we're in this balancing act of we've got to make Kirk Cousins feel good. Oh, but we just drafted this kid. Raheem Morris, the head coach of the Falcons over the weekend, solidified the fact there's no battle here. Kirk Cousins is the quarterback. He said, quote, we came up with a decision. Kirk is not looking over his shoulder. This is not the case. We are here to win, and we are here to win, to go win it all, et cetera. So there you got the head coach saying, hey, Penix, you don't even have a shot at this job. But I grant you it's not good for Michael Penix Jr. I finally found the guy who's really making the case that it's a good move for the team, and that is Trent Dilfer, Super Bowl-winning quarterback. Now, many would argue with the fact that whether he won that Super Bowl or not, or he just rode the back of the defense, but he's got a ring. The Falcons, who gave Kirk Cousins $100 million guaranteed in the first 2 years, that's where Steve's 2 years thing came from, according to Trent Dilfer, says that it's a brilliant idea. In fact, that's a quote, brilliant, because he says Penix will be backing up Cousins for a while, but Dilfer sees the analogy that I tried as devil's advocate to throw at you, Steve, the Brett Favre, Aaron Rodgers, Jordan Love plan. Quote, Cousins is going to play as good a football as he can for as long as his body allows him to play. And while he does that, you will not find a better human to help Michael Penix grow as a person, as a player. Every time the Packers did this, every time people said this was stupid, I think it's one of the best models in all of football. The Falcons are looking 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the line. They're looking to become Super Bowl contenders for a decade, not just change the franchise now. And because of that, I think it's a really good pick. End quote. Tell a Super Bowl champion quarterback why he's wrong.
With that scenario, if you listen and read it, Kirk Cousins at quarterback there for 2 years. He just signed for 4 years, $180 million, and you're basically telling Kirk Cousins that, yes, you're going to play for 2 years. We're going to let you out of your contract. You're going to move on, and you're going to have to go find another contract because you're not ready to retire yet. And, oh, by the way, during this time, you're going to have to mentor Michael Penix Jr., who will be your heir apparent, best quarterback possible. Let's see here. Brett Favre didn't do that with Aaron Rodgers because he didn't want to have to be that mentor. We see it all the time. And then you take the age of Penix Jr. As I said, he's the most experienced college quarterback. He's not 20, 21 coming out. He's already 24, going to be 25. By the time he becomes the starting quarterback, you're looking at him 27, 28 years old. He's already taken away from these young quarterbacks like 6 years of an NFL career to develop, learn how to play the game, and become one of the elite quarterbacks in the game. You've taken that all away from him. Where's his motivation either? Because I'm just sitting there and maybe I get to play my third, fourth year, which then the team doesn't even know what they have. So I'm not getting my huge contract after my rookie deal because I still have to prove it. So it takes me longer to get the big money. It, to me, is a bad, bad for both of them.
And it's a mess in either scenario. I don't think, look, this is why we play the games. I don't think any of us believe the Falcons are going to be in the Super Bowl in 25. But what if they have a really good year and then Cousins goes into the next year, the second season. They make the playoffs this year. My God, they should. They're in the South, for God's sakes. And then all the pressure's on Cousins. Oh, but he knows it's his lame duck year. But what if he wins the Super Bowl? And then Penix is demoralized. Or what if Cousins goes out in 25, 26 and doesn't start strong? Well, he's demoralized because he knows he's not going to be, oh, my God, we got to take a break. We'll finish this and get to baseball, basketball, hockey, and more on the other side of this.
Knicks Picks, the Knicks Picks Sports Show.
All right, just a quick little post-mortem on the NFL draft. And when we got to teams that did the worst or had the worst draft, we right away jumped on the Falcons. Trent Dilfer has explained why he thinks it's a brilliant move. It did not sway Steve or me. Another team that was mentioned a lot, which brings us to a bit of quote-unquote breaking news, a lot of people said the Cowboys did not have a very good draft and that Dallas left this gaping hole at running back, which, Steve, when we were talking Friday, you figured they were going to use the second, the third, the ongoing rounds to get a running back. They didn't really, but they've gone back to a story you and I talked about weeks ago when it was rumored, and all sources are saying it's a done deal now that Ezekiel Elliott has agreed to a new deal with the Dallas Cowboys to reunite him with the franchise that took him with the fourth overall pick in 2016. And it looks like, I mean, at this point, it looks like he's the lead running back. Is that the answer?
No, not at all. There's no gas left in that tank at all. They're bringing him back because who he was and what he meant to the franchise. You know, the other two teams with I didn't care for the drafts were the Cowboys and the Raiders. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked on Friday. I really thought the Raiders got caught flat-footed. They really thought they were going to get the quarterback would slide to them. It didn't happen. Thank you, Atlanta Falcons. And from that point, it just seemed like they were just trying to recover through the whole thing. And you know, one of the things, just sitting there watching it, and the Niners, to me, had a surprisingly strong draft. I think people felt that they overreached. I think the 49ers did excellent. They got players, I think, that are going to be impact players. And I rolled to their fourth-round draft pick, the kid out of Louisville. I mean, he's a big back with speed. They compare him to Elijah Mitchell. Why don't the Cowboys take him in, like, the fourth round? He's like a Pacheco. We've seen him take over as the starting running back with the Chiefs. He was there in the fourth round, and you don't even select him. These are the things where I think the Cowboys messed up. I thought there was talent on the board. Mustafa, I think, is going to be a really good add depth to that 49ers secondary. I like Puni. I thought the Niners had a solid draft without big splashy names.
Having somebody solid to either spell McCaffrey or allow them to use McCaffrey in other areas is a big deal. It goes to your argument of depth with the 49ers. Obviously, the big unknown with the 49ers remains they didn't do what I thought was a really good idea when you presented it on Friday, which was the idea of going into day two, would they trade Deebo Samuels, maybe to the Buffalo Bills or the Patriots, who had the first two picks Friday, in exchange for whatever they would need to then bolster that defense, et cetera, because how in the world are they going to keep Ayuk and Deebo and take care of Brock Purdy moving forward? And the answer today is the same as it was Wednesday. We have no idea. That's the only thing that's hanging out there is Lynch, the general manager, John Lynch. Is he going to find a way to work his salary cap magic, sign Ayuk, and then do whatever he's going to do with Deebo after the next season, which a lot of people are thinking that's when they say bye-bye, Deebo, especially after drafting a wide receiver. Otherwise, I mean, they sure look loaded for this season.
they are. And I think at the end of the day, that's what they were looking at. Let's keep them both. Let's find out what it is. Let's make another Super Bowl run. Maybe we can win it here. But the guy I kept saying, if I'm the 49ers and I'm looking to trade, you know, Debo, as I had said, you know, Cooper DeJean, the quarterback out of Iowa, he's the one that the Eagles go and trade up. Again, love the move. The Eagles secondary was awful. They got two of the best cornerbacks in the draft that are both going to step up and play pretty much immediately, and I think they will contribute. But he was the guy that I was looking for. If I'm the 49ers, I'm looking to move Debo for him. Obviously, the 49ers are much smarter than I am, and they chose not to go that route. But that's what I was thinking the 49ers would do that would make a lot of sense.
All right, we're going to jump sports to the NHL. We got this email, rad@radradio.com, from Alec, who says, Logan Thompson, that's the goalie for the Vegas Golden Knights, played solo against the Dallas Stars, has this whole series, oh my God, four total periods. This is talking specifically about Saturday night's game. And the Knights only had defense in the third. Poor Logan is carrying the entire team on his back. Dallas has the better team. Vegas has the better goalie. Let's hope for Vegas in five. Alec is rooting for the Knights. I don't know if he's a Knights fan proper. First of all, do you see it that way, Steve? The way he described it, and then what do you look for? Because the game, the next game is tonight. Dallas is back at Vegas with Vegas up 2-1.
Vegas needs to win this game or everything they accomplished in Dallas goes away. Dallas is the better team. I mean, they're the number one seed in the West. Some could argue they are the best team in the NHL. But in game three, the Golden Knights were outplayed pretty much at every aspect. I mean, they had to score a shorthanded goal in order to tie it up to send it into overtime. You had to expect that kind of effort from the Stars. There was no way they wanted to go down 0-3. But this is the game Vegas needs to step up. I think Vegas has a lot more talent than the email writer saying. I do think Vegas is the second best team in the Western Conference. You know, Eichel, Stone is back healthy, skating well. The defense for the Golden Knights this year has not been the defense the Golden Knight fans have come to expect over the years. So it has let them down, but this is still a very deep team, a solid team, but they have to take care of business tonight.
Is Vegas favored tonight at home?
They all the Stars are $1.20 favorite. So the Stars are a slight favorite here. But also keep in mind the Stars were the best road team in the NHL. They had the best record on the road, where the Knights struggled on the road, although first two games at Dallas didn't seem to struggle. But they just get in front. They were playing catch up the whole game in game three, but they have to get out front like they did in the first two games.
So the Rangers swept Washington. That was yesterday. That game finished up. That series finished up. And Dallas and Vegas, they're, you know, it's 2-1. If Vegas wins tonight, that series goes to 3-1. And that's where every other series is. I mean, do we have, other than pending the outcome of Dallas and Vegas tonight, Steve, do we have any real series right now in the NHL? Because it seems like they're all kind of fait accomplis.
Nah, there's a couple that's really interesting in my opinion. Nashville, Vancouver. Vancouver's Demko's their goalie. He's one of the finalists for the best goalie of the year. He was hurt late in the season. He's now out possibly for the remainder of this. DeSmith's their backup goalie. He is now out. He missed this last game. So they were down to their third and fourth string goalies. They found a way to win last night, which is amazing to me, because when it came out that DeSmith wasn't playing, everybody jumped on the Predators in this game, and the Canucks found a way to win with a third string goalie. The other one is the Kings Oilers, and I'm one of the people that's been critical of the Oilers because of their failure to advance deep in the playoffs. But this Oilers team's playing disciplined hockey. Skinner, their goalie, shutout last night, played great in game three. They're just sitting back, and they are executing on their power plays. They've scored 8 goals on like 15 attempts, and their power play kills have stopped the Kings. The Kings have not scored on a power play the entire playoffs. So the Oilers have stepped up to play like the team we've been expecting the last several years. And the Kings played almost a flawless game. They had one penalty, boom, Oilers power play goal. That was the game, 1-0.
So, I mean, so in other words, back to the question at hand, the Edmonton, they're up 3-1. That series is over. All these series are over except for, so, I mean, you're not giving Vancouver a chance, are you, to win the series?
Oh, Vancouver's up 3-1. It's the Predators.
I'm sorry. You're right. I got that backwards.
Vancouver's up 3-1, but I'm giving them a chance because if DeSmith is out the rest of the playoffs also, you're running a third-string goalie for the remainder of the playoffs. That's tough to consistently win.
Sorry, I meant to say you're not giving Nashville a chance, even though they're down to their third-string goalie. So you are saying that being down 3-1, that Nashville's the one you're looking at as having a chance.
Yes, just solely due to that goalie situation. The other one that I'm still sweating, even though Boston's up 3-1, is really? I need the Maple Leafs out. You know, you were talking about people steaming the Rangers. Well, for me, it's the Maple Leafs, so I need the Maple Leafs gone.
Why?
Just because that's our biggest liability, hands down, in the NHL futures.
So from the sports booking or for the sports betting standpoint, for sport, not like, oh, I'm going to worry that my Vegas Golden Knights are going to lose to them.
This is all from the sports booking aspects.
Okay. I mean, when you say "our," I've got to clarify: is it our Vegas Golden Knights because you're a fan, you live there in Vegas, they're your 1A team? This is more from the, hey, I've been running sports books my whole career, and I don't need Toronto getting there.
Correct.
And why, explain real quickly, because I know we did it last week, but explain real quickly to people that don't understand why would sportsbooks not want Toronto in there?
Well, because then we lose a lot of money. And at the end of the day, when you're running a sportsbook, your job is to take these bets, determine what bets you accept and how much you will take. And you need to, like a stockbroker, you got to outperform the market. You need to make money. That is your job. Everyone thinks running a sports book is just watching sports on TV. It's not a case. You handle millions and millions, and depending on the company, you know, billions of dollars. At the end of the day, every boss wants their money, and you need to earn a certain percentage off of those bets to keep your job.
So Boston's up 3-1. From your professional sports booking real life, you just want to see Boston close it out. Now, just as a fan, you don't really think Toronto has a chance to come back, do you?
No, I think Boston's a really solid team. I've seen them blow 3-1 leads in the past, and I just don't want it to be another repeat.
Just get something off of Steve's list here. All right, they play again, by the way, tomorrow. Toronto is at Boston. We're back after this.
Mix Picks, the Mix Picks Sports Show.
All right, we got it caught up on the Stanley Cup finals and the playoffs, the march towards the finals, et cetera, as we jump over to the NBA. We've called it for the Sixers for the most part. And yesterday, after seeing a sea of, he's not wrong from what I saw when I was tuning in and out, of Knicks fans invade Wells Fargo Center yesterday afternoon to watch the Knicks take a commanding 3-1 lead. Center Joel Embiid of the Sixers expressed disappointment that there were so many Knicks fans inside his home arena. He said, quote, "I love our fans. I'm not calling them out." Pause in his quote, and then he calls them out. Back to the quote, "I'm not calling them out, but it is disappointing. I've never seen it. I've been here for 10 years. It pisses me off, especially because Philly is considered a sports town. They've always shown up, and I don't think that should happen. It's not okay," end quote. So he's not calling them out, but he called them out. Frustrated superstar syndrome here, a legitimate complaint, Steve. I mean, this happens. Teams have fan bases that can travel. Philly's not far from New York for those that know nothing about the other side of the country if you're a West Coaster sort of thing. I mean, it's a drive. I've done the drive. It's a couple hours. It's easy.
Disappointing for Philadelphia fans. I'm watching that game going, man, there just seems to be a lot of Knicks fans and cheers.
There were.
And that was a game the Sixers really needed to win. And to not have that home court with the fans behind you rocking that arena, very disappointing. Not saying the Sixers would have won, but as a player, you want that support. You want that home court advantage, and it wasn't there.
No. And so whether he's getting flack for it or will, is Embiid right to speak out like that?
Yes, you want the fans to show up. You want the team to do a little bit better job at controlling the tickets and who purchases it. you know, you want that white out atmosphere when you get those different arenas and everybody's in white and they're waving the towels. That's what you're looking for. And again, it didn't happen. It was a game played on a neutral court.
So you can't have the same question as in the NHL with any legitimacy to say, are any of the other series, do any of them matter, sort of thing? Because there's a couple that, whether they surprise people or not, that are close. A lot of them have been kind of meh so far. Now, the one you said from the beginning that you were watching, that I said from the beginning was the most compelling. Yesterday, the Clippers evened up the series against the Mavs. It's 2-2. Now, the last time I talked to you, you have the Mavs going all the way to the Western Finals. It's 2-2. I don't know if we ever pinned each other down on this, but I saw this series going 7 to begin with. First of all, do you still see the Mavs winning this and going all the way to the Western Conference Finals? And do you see it needing 7 to get there?
I still see the Mavs getting there. I've just been really disappointed. In the one game, they scored 8 points in the second quarter. They dug such a huge hole. And then last night's game, I'm watching it. They're down 30-plus in the second quarter. You can't dig that big of a hole. I think Lucas started 0-for-10, and maybe I'm wrong there, but they dug such a big hole, and you'll see it. A team will fight and get back and get close, maybe even take a slight lead, but they're out of gas because they had to sprint to get back into that game. And last night's game, it was great to see Kyrie step up, had a big game for the Mavs to put them back in it. But you can't win when you have 50% of their games, they've gone through these scoring droughts that have just buried this team.
Now stating the obvious, that was a home victory. That was a road victory for the Clippers. And now the Clippers are at home on Wednesday. That's got to be a must-win road game for Dallas, or no, because of the way this thing will now teeter back and forth because of the – you and I remember when it was always 2-3-2. Hasn't been that way for over a decade. But in my mind, I still get stuck in 2-3-2 land because that's how we grew up even as young adults. So is it as vital as it would be otherwise for Dallas to win on Wednesday in L.A., or can they go ahead, lose that one, and then flop back? They're going to have to win in L.A. if they're going to go.
They have to win L.A. if they're going to advance in the playoffs. I like the spot here. You have to get it done. You still don't know where Kawhi's at. I would rather win it faster than give Kawhi a chance to come back, even though he played in game 2, wasn't effective, and that's the game that the Mavs won in L.A. The Mavs are a 2.5-point favorite right now in that game that's going to be played Wednesday, but Game 5 is always such a pivotal game. You win Game 5, usually you win the series.
I'm going to leapfrog over tonight's games to get to the other tied series. And I don't know if this is my NBA ignorance or if I'm being a big city flyover type guy here. I've had no interest in Orlando at Cleveland from the jump, and yet somehow this series is tied at 2-2. So it's the other close series. Should I be paying more attention, Steve?
I pay attention to Game 5. The Cavs did not show up. They had an ugly showing in Orlando in these games. I like the Cavs. I think they're a better play, and I think it's due to their guard play. Mobley and Allen line up well against the Magic, but they didn't show up. And how you can be a playoff team and not show up in two of your games, they have to show up here. I think they will. I think they find a way to win Game 5. This game opened 4.5 or 5. I saw a lot of fives on the board. It's back down to 4.5. So there is that money coming in on the Magic. It's just Game 5 is so pivotal at home. Cavs have to get it done because that was not the Cavs team we saw on the road in Orlando.
Probably spend a little bit more time on that game tomorrow because the game is tomorrow night. Also, one other note, I'm aware of it. I just don't want to skim over it because I've been thinking, we have until the summer to talk about this. But it has been announced today that the Mike Tyson-Jake Paul fight, which we haven't talked about at all, so for those of you whose heads are spinning around, yes, that's going to happen, and it is going to be a sanctioned professional fight. I will work that in this week, maybe as early as tomorrow, just to get everybody, get Steve and I to talk about it, talk about what boxing used to be, what we think of this, whether it's an exhibition or a freak show or something real. But the other thing, as we get to tonight, Steve, so the Heat, who you know I've kind of been like, I like the Heat. I like Spoelstra. I don't have a basketball team. The Kings are gone. They didn't get the play-in game. So I'm just watching this as a fan of the game. And the Heat steal one in Boston, and then they look ridiculous on Saturday. I mean, that was awful. So they're at 2-1. Boston leads. OKC is up 3-0. These are the games tonight. The Lakers, yay, whoop-de-doo, they got a game. They're down 3-1 to the Nuggets. These three games, do any of these series matter?
No, not really. I agree with you on Spoelstra. I think he is one of the best, if not the best, head coach in the NBA. But it's not their year. It's just not. The Celtics are going to take care of business. OKC, a lot of fun to watch, but the Pelicans just don't match up. The Lakers, if you want to give a team, the Lakers have like double-digit leads in the first three games that they still lose. I mean, I'm not sure if any NBA team has ever done that. They've been in it. They just can't close. They wear down the second half. Anthony Davis disappears. LeBron, to me, is visibly frustrated. And I think the Nuggets just take the series, end it, put the Laker fans out of their misery,
please,
and just move on.
Yeah, put us all out of our misery so we get just get the Lakers, just let them take a break for a little while. And that's not me as a Kings fan hating the Lakers. It's just we're done with them for now. I got two baseball stories, but one of them is not super timely, so I want to do this just because we just talked last week about how awful the Chicago White Sox are, and people are already writing. I mean, it's painfully early again. I'm going to say that until the All-Star break in baseball. People are already writing that the White Sox could break the record for most losses slash fewest wins, actually, really. Could they get to 120 losses, I think it is, or whatever that number was. And then the White Sox go out, and they sweep. Was it Tampa Bay this weekend? So suddenly, the White Sox are tied with the Marlins. I mean, the Marlins technically are the worst team in in baseball because they played one more game and they lost it. Both teams have six wins. I don't know what. Now, the White Sox start another homestand tonight. They're hosting the Twins. Is there anything that happened this weekend that should make us rethink our thoughts on the White Sox before I get to the really big question?
They're really not as bad as the record has shown. They have some players who can play. They're just, I don't know what happened at the start. They were awful. They couldn't score any runs. End of the season, to me, the two worst teams are not the Florida Marlins. They are the Rockies and the A's. I think the A's are still the worst team, but they're playing really good baseball. I mean, they're 12-17. They're making a run here. They're playing 400 baseball. I just think when you roll 162 games, the A's and the Rockies are the two worst teams in Major League Baseball.
Okay, so that's the big one, but you qualify. So when you look at it, if you look at single-digit teams, and, you know, all these teams have played right around 30 games, give or take. You throw the Astros out. I mean, the Astros right now are miserably disappointing. They're not going to be the worst team in baseball. At 9-19, last place, behind the Angels, behind the A's, we've talked about the panic button for the Astros, but if we're talking about worst team in baseball when all is said and done, it's not going to be the Astros. They might be the most disappointing, but they're not going to be the worst team. And so you look at it, you got the White Sox, and you've disqualified them from the running. You've got the A's and the Rockies as one of those two, if I heard right, as the worst teams. Why not the Marlins? Why aren't they in the running for worst?
And I got to correct myself. I think I said the Florida Marlins, the Miami Marlins.
Yeah.
At a certain point, and I know they've had a lot of devastating injuries to the pitching staff, but I still think they have enough good young talent, enough pitching there to be competitive. The thing I'm hoping happens, and I've been watching this weekend and hope it comes to this, I want to see the White Sox, as awful of a start as they have, catch the Houston Astros in wins. That would be such a blow in my mind to the Astros that we watch the White Sox have as bad of a start to a season. And, oh, by the way, they still have as many wins as the Astros before all their pitching gets healthy and they get it going again. That, to me, is something I'd like to see happen.
By the way, the other sideshow we've been watching and chronicling is whether or not, you know, do the A's have a game where they have fewer than 1,000 people in attendance, because they had set it at 3,300, then they got 3,200 and change. And we started looking forward to the schedule, and we had pegged a homestand, was it in August, I think, during the week where they host the Chicago White Sox. Now, tonight, they're back home. The A's are back home, but it's Monday, and they could be doing that dollar thing they do where seats are $2 and hot dogs are $1 for tonight. So I don't know if tonight will show us anything, because they're hosting the Pittsburgh Pirates. Not exactly a big draw. Now, Steeler fans travel really well. You go to almost any major city of note. I mean, Sacramento has an enormous Steeler fan population. There are Steeler bars. The Pirates, not so much. But whether or not, I don't think tonight's the barometer. Tomorrow night on a Tuesday night, the A's host the Steelers. They might set a new season low. They're not going to get below 1,000. I don't even think below 2,000. And part of that is what you alluded to, Steve. Okay, they're under 500. They're 12-17. No one expected them to have 12 wins at the All-Star break.
No, not at all. And they're leaving, and there's a bad taste in the split. And I think that's part of it, is the fans feel betrayed. So why are they going to continue supporting the A's? Oh, you know, if it was a good breakup, yeah, let's support them. They're going away. Mm-hmm. Hey, but I'm still an A's fan. That's not the case here. And I was watching video footage of the A's game. I want to say it was April 14th. I think that was the day of the game. And they showed the stadium.
Oh.
And again, I don't know when it was, but watching that footage, I would have said there's not 500 fans sitting in it. They just showed almost the entire stadium was empty. It was like no one anywhere in the outfield, no one like outside of the dugouts. And I would love to have seen what the attendance was for that. And it could have been video taken in the eighth inning, and the A's were getting blown out and everybody left early. But
still,
I'd still like to see them go under 1,000.
Two quick comments. One, if they're already padding numbers at this point in the season, how pathetic is that? And two, as the guy who had season tickets in the late 80s and 90s, going to those early 90s, going to those games at the same stadium, and that's one of the reasons the A's were leaving, and seeing it sold out night after night after night, those images are shockingly sad on so many levels. I will talk to you again, Steve, in 23 hours. Have a great day.
Thank you.
There's the pass to Leitner. Puts it up. Yes! Little roller up along first. Behind the bag.